3, 2, 1, 0.
From the studios of WORQ in Wisconsin, this is the Stand Up for the Truth podcast. Today's issues, overlooked headlines, and biblical observations, equipping the remnant around the globe. Got your sword handy? This is Stand Up for the Truth.
Good morning. It is Thursday, May 2, 2024, the National Day of Prayer. I'm Krish Connell, and it is a brand new podcast today with a first-time guest, Mary Danielson.
Good morning, everyone. I'm looking forward very much to chatting with Olivier Melnick this morning. The headlines, we were just talking about this before we got on the air. The headlines change overnight. You never know what you're going to expect. This morning, a massive police operation dismantles UCLA pro-Palestinian camp, makes numerous arrests. So that is what happened while you were sleeping. I also ran into a quote that I want to read here. I wish I had the attribution for it. I do not. It says, every parent's biggest nightmare, sending their kids to college so they can have a better future only to get them back as part of the pro-Palestinian zombie cult that is roaming the elite education institutions in the USA. Where are the parents in all this? Well, that's one of my questions for today. And I have several for Olivier Melnick. I'm so pleased that he had time for us this morning. And so I'm going to jump in, and I'm going to start with a scripture from Ezekiel 36, 24 to 28. For I will take you out of the nations. I will gather you from all the countries and bring you back into your own land. I will sprinkle clean water on you, and you will be clean. I will cleanse you from all your impurities and from all your idols. I will give you a new heart and put a new spirit in you. I will remove from you your heart of stone and give you a heart of flesh. And I will put my spirit in you and move you to follow my decrees and be careful to keep my laws. Then you will live in the land I gave your ancestors. You will be my people, and I will be your God. What an incredible prophecy. Would you pray with me this morning? Oh, Lord, your enduring mercy and truth continue to comfort us and give us hope in the knowledge that you will do all you say, and you are a God who keeps his promises, Lord. Where would we be without that? Help us to keep eternity at the forefront of our minds and hearts so we can bring the hope of the kingdom to those we encounter, Lord. We also lift up Israel and her leaders, Lord, that you would have your hand on them. We know you're working out your perfect will for your people. We lift up Olivier to you this morning and thank you for his testimony and the gifts you've given him. And we ask for endurance for him and good health for him and his loved ones. Lord, guide and direct his steps. Give him wisdom and insights and protect him in Jesus' name. Amen. Olivier Melnick is a Jewish believer in Jesus from France, the son of Holocaust survivors. He is an internationally known speaker on anti-Semitism. He holds a BA from Moody Bible Institute and a master's from Dallas Theological Seminary. He's been equipping believers to understand and fight anti-Semitism since 2000. He has written 5 books on the topic and contributed over 600 articles to print and digital media. He currently serves with Chosen People Ministries as a U.S. regional director and vice president of their French work. ShalomInMessiah.com is the website. Olivier, welcome to Stand Up for the Truth. It's great to have you with us.
Well, thank you for having me. Just a small correction. I was with Chosen People Ministries for 26 years, and then I started Shalom and Messiah a few months ago. So, but that's, you know, and the website is shalomandmessiah.com.
Yes, great. Thank you for correcting that. So, shalomandmessiah.com, that's where you want to go for so many great articles. Olivia, I want to start out by asking you about your story and tell us a bit about your background. It goes back a couple generations and how the Lord worked in your life. What happened for you?
Well, born in, like you mentioned in the introduction, born in France from a Jewish family, and parents were Holocaust, my mother was a Holocaust survivor, and I was raised, like 85% of the Jewish people of the world, I was raised agnostic, secular, but Jewish. And I didn't do much with it, didn't care much about it until I met the young woman in 1981 who would become my wife of 41 years today, this year, a Gentile who basically I wanted to marry her, and she said, I cannot marry you unless we're equally yoked. And then so she started a journey where I was introduced to the messianic prophecies of the Old Testament, and then I read a book called The Late Great Planet Earth. Mm. Many people will know this book. Mm-hmm. It was also aging me. and this led to my coming to my Messiah, Yeshua, Jesus, in the summer of, in July of 1983, and then moved back to the States. We got married, moved back to the States, and gradually, like you said in the introduction, went to Moody, went to Dallas Seminary, and starting in 2000, I was putting together a message when I was at Moody, and I was looking for examples to use that in that message on Psalm 83. And I looked in the news, and it was the time of the Second Intifada, and I thought, maybe I can find some examples of anti-Semitism. And that's what started this journey where I'm still on today, where for the last 24 years almost, I have been studying, teaching, equipping the body of Messiah on how to fight anti-Semitism and how to reach out the Jewish community to better understand them and to share the gospel of Yeshua with them. So this anti-Semitism has become my wheelhouse, so to speak, for the last 23 to almost 24 years. And, Mary, I got to tell you, when I started writing the books and doing conferences and speaking engagements, I would tell people, we need to be ready because the Bible tells us that the whole world is going to turn against the Jewish mm-hmm. people. I mean, you can quote Zechariah 12:3, which basically says that, all people will go against Jerusalem. Well, it feels like we're here right now. Mm. But I'm always encouraged by Zechariah 12:9 that says that God will go after all those who go after Jerusalem. So we know that justice will be served. But I used to tell people it's going to get really bad, and we give examples. People thought I was a little crazy at the beginning, that I would, you're so negative, Olivier. Well, I never thought it would be that bad the way we are today in my own lifetime. Mm-hmm. That I never thought I would experience. Mm-hmm. I knew it was coming to be bad, and it's probably going to get a little worse. I never thought we would be where we are today. My eschatological position is I'm premillennial, pre-trib. I believe the next event is the rapture. Not everybody believes that. Mm-hmm. I understand. Mm-hmm. But from my perspective, the next event is the rapture. And I thought that everything we're seeing right now would be the beginning of what we would see during the tribulation. And yet, right. we're not in the tribulation, and we're seeing the whole world turning against the Jews. And it's just, it's so, so mind-boggling. Like you said, we every morning we get up thinking, what is today going to bring? Yeah. What's new today? I mean, I woke up to this UCLA this morning. We're looking at those students, and there's some people in the U.S. in the last couple of years have been accused of being domestic terrorists, mm-hmm. and they're not. But I'm looking at those kids, and I'm going like, you know what? That would be a good definition to apply to them when they're calling for the death of Jewish people. They're calling for Jews to go back to the ovens. They say burn Tel Aviv. Mm-hmm. They say, where is this going? This is crazy.
Yeah, it really is shocking to me. Hal Lindsey, speaking of him, he released an article on April the 28th called The Jewish Question. And he talks about Hitler in 1922, 3 years before Mein Kampf. He told a journalist, "Once I really am in power, my first and foremost task will be the annihilation of the Jews." And no one believed him, and no one thought he would gain power. And then Joseph Goebbels speaks up and he says, "Well, we have 160,000 dead from World War I of our own German people, and we're not going to let that happen again. And those who started it will pay." Speaking of the Jews, so Hal is talking about this today. And I never thought people say, well, you talk too much about the Holocaust. No, clearly not enough because of what has been taking place in our lifetime here. It's just mind-boggling, Olivier. And I want to ask you about a couple of definitions. I think it would be great to start out with those. Anti-Semitism. This is interesting because, as you say, it goes much deeper than we might realize. And I want to add to that, it can spread globally in the blink of an eye. And what happens in Israel now is used against all Jews. So where do we get that term Semite, Olivier?
Well, the Semite, in Genesis, you get the, I believe it's in Genesis 6, if I'm correct, the story of Noah and his, you know, and his three sons, and in Genesis 6, we have that story, and then the three sons are, one of them, Shem, is the father of the Semite, of the Semites, which, by the way, are Arabs and Jews.
Mm-hmm.
And what I always found fascinating is that the word anti-Semitism is never once been used to describe the hatred of Arabs. And yet,
wow.
To be of Semitic descent means that you can be a Jew or an Arab, but to be anti-Semitic always means that you hate the Jews. It's interesting that it's just used for half of the people here. But as far as the definition, you know, there's a globally accepted definition, which is known as the IHRA definition. Proposed in 2016. The IHRA is the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance, and their definition is, if I may just read it,
mm-hmm.
Anti-Semitism is a certain perception of Jews which may be expressed as hatred towards Jews. Rhetorical and physical manifestations of anti-Semitism are directed toward Jewish or non-Jewish individuals and or their property, towards Jewish community, institutions, and religious facilities. They have this definition that slowly but surely has been adopted by organizations, by countries, by parties,
mm-hmm.
And this, I guess this is the ongoing accepted definition. I have my own, and it is different in two ways. My definition adds two words, which I think as believers, as Christians, we would understand the importance of adding those two words. That I got to tell you, Mary, I have on my shelf, I'm looking, I'm in my office, so I have hundreds of books on the Holocaust and on anti-Semitism by many, many, many wonderful scholars and theologians. That are way, way more educated and way smarter than me by a long shot. And yet, I have to find one definition of anti-Semitism that includes the words that I think are critical to the definition. And my definition goes like this. Anti-Semitism is the irrational and satanic mm-hmm. hatred of the Jewish people and Israel, characterized by thoughts, words, and deeds against them. And the key words, Mary, is irrational and satanic, or demonic, if you prefer. And once you understand who is behind anti-Semitism and others about how to fight it, you cannot fight an enemy if you don't know the enemy.
Yeah.
And anti-Semitism is a 100% creation of Satan.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Go ahead.
Oh, well, and I was just going to add that the Satan is using the church to turn against the Jews, too. May it never be, Olivier, but we are seeing so much of the replacement theology and all that, and that's the one that breaks my heart the most.
Well, yes. See, the reason why Satan is behind anti-Semitism it's a theological reason. It's a biblical reason. And, you know, for the benefit of your audience, maybe I should say a few words on that. We don't realize it, but Satan knows the Bible very well.
Mm.
And he knows what has happened, he knows what's happening, and he knows what's coming. And now, he's not omniscient, but he knows the Bible very well. And so what's happening is he knows that there's a time coming in the future known as the Great Tribulation, also known as the time of Jacob's trouble, which, by the way, when you call it the time of Jacob's trouble, you understand that this is a time where God is going to resume his program with the Jewish people, with Israel. And the scripture you read, it's very interesting, the very scripture you read this morning, I have put a message together about about the Jewish people, their return from the diaspora and going back in the land, and that very passage that you read, when you read it, I was very, very familiar. It reminded me of that message. It's an important scripture. I really appreciate that you quoted that. But Satan knows that at the end of 7 year tribulation, the Jewish people corporately, as a people, are going to realize that they missed the first time that Yeshua, Jesus, came in his first coming. They missed him as Messiah. They rejected him as Messiah. And not corporately, there's always been a remnant of Jewish believers like myself.
Mm-hmm.
But the vast majority of Jewish people rejected Yeshua at his first coming. It's going to be a time at the end of the tribulation, the Jews who would have survived the tribulation will look up and say, Baruch haba b'shem Adonai, blessed is you who comes in the name of the Lord. Yeshua himself warned them in Matthew 23, 37 through 40. He said, you won't see me again until you say, blessed is you who comes in the name of the Lord. So what the church needs to realize, that number one, like you said, they have not replaced Israel. Beyond that, Israel is very much a part of the end times, because it is not until Israel corporately, the Jewish people corporately, call upon the one whom they have pierced, which is a quote of Zechariah 12:10. It is not until that happens that Yeshua returns, the second coming. And so the second coming of Jesus, it hinges on the calling by Israel. But what happens at the second coming is that Satan is out of a job, and he doesn't like his retirement plan.
Mm-hmm.
So he's going to want to stop it, put an end to it. That the Jews cannot call Jesus to come back, because then I'm going to the lake of fire for all eternity. So he is the one behind anti-Semitism, the hatred against the Jews, and turning people against the Jews, and turning the Jews against Jesus in a way that, I mean, you see it. Any other religion of the world, Jewish people can be, I'm Jewish, but I practice Buddhism. I'm Jewish, and I practice transcendental meditation. I practice, anything. But if you practice Christianity, then the Jewish community says, well, you're not Jewish anymore.
Yeah. Wow.
And so Satan really has done a really good job at separating, ostracizing the Jews and making them the people that the way that people paint the Jewish people today. And the reason why it's irrational is because you see, I mean, right now you see on the campuses, you see groups like Queers for Palestine. Go show your flag in the Middle East, and they'll throw you off a roof if you're a gay person. That's what they're going to do.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's so irrational, it's satanic, and it's irrational. And until people understand that, they will not be able to understand anti-Semitism or fight it.
Yes, absolutely. And I noticed back in March, and this is part of one of your articles on anti-Semitism that's on your site, shalominmessiah.com, that in Cambridge University over in England, There was a pro-Palestinian group slashed and spray-painted an old painting of Lord Balfour, of course, the author of the Balfour Declaration, which gave momentum for the birth of the modern state of Israel. And so we have to cancel Lord Balfour now, too, because anything that has anything to do with anything clearly has to be canceled. And so it just never ends. And so then I guess what I want to ask you about is Zionism, biblical Zionism. What is that? Because that is not a very good word these days either, even within the church in some cases. Tell us what biblical Zionism is.
Well, Zionism is, it's a movement, if you will, for the reestablishment of the biblical ancestral land of Israel. I always tell people, if you ever want to go back to the beginning of Zionism, well, God was the first Zionist.
Mm-hmm.
God is the one who established the land of Israel, and he gave that promise to Abraham in the Genesis 12, 1 through 3, and he ratified that promise into a covenant in Genesis 15 at the very end of the chapter, when he gives basically the boundaries for what Israel will be in Genesis 15, 17 through 19, all the different lands that are going to form Israel, which, by the way, Israel today is a very small sliver of land. In the millennial kingdom, it will be twice the size of Texas, when today it's about the size of New Jersey, to give perspective. But biblical Zionism is if you're a biblical Zionist, you basically understand that God is not done with Israel, that the land of Israel has been given to the Jewish people by God. It's a decree. It's that he owns the land, really. It is my land, he says this, I believe, in Numbers, in the earlier chapters. I found the address escapes me right now. He says that he says it's his land, but he has given the deed to Israel and to the Jewish people. And so that land is Jewish land by God's decree. And biblical Zionism in general is this idea that it's this movement that started in the mid-1800s out of Europe to bring the Jews back to their ancestral land. And, of course, with 1948, which we're about to celebrate in a couple of weeks, the rebirth of Israel as a modern state, May 14th, 1948, This was accomplished, and like you mentioned, Lord Balfour, this was part of the process by which Israel was born as a modern nation. So Zionism is not occupation. Zionism is not colonization. Zionism is not racism. Zionism is simply a movement that recognizes that the Jewish people own the land of Israel, and they are entitled to live in it. And this, you know, and the way Zionism grew, really, there was we don't have time to go into that, but there was cultural Zionism, political Zionism, religious Zionism. But what they have in common is that they include this longing for going back to the ancestral biblical land of Israel that was given by God to the Jewish people.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and I don't believe there's any other civilization in history that was in exile that actually came back to their own land. It is a miracle. And Leviticus 25:23 is what you were talking about. The land, moreover, shall not be sold permanently, for the land is mine.
That's it. Leviticus 25:23. Yes. Not Numbers.
Yes,
that's right. The land belongs to God, but he's given the deed to the Jewish people. And we need to say this: the fact that he's given the land to the Jewish people does not make the descendants of Ishmael lesser people. It does not make the Arabs inferior. It just makes the land of Israel was given to the Jewish people. When you look at the size of Israel today in the Middle East and in the midst of Arab Muslim countries, it's almost invisible. It's so small.
Yeah.
And it does not, it's not saying that, you know, the Arabs are inferior or they're lesser people. It's just saying that God, by God's prerogative, he's given that piece of land to the Jewish people. Mm-hmm. And that's it. But
right.
Again, without the Satan component of him trying to eradicate the Jews so he can keep his job, the people don't understand that. But so Jews and Arabs, when I look, you know, I often have to repeat that when I speak in different places, that, you know, because I speak on anti-Semitism, and a lot of it, unfortunately, comes from radical Islam. But I we have to remind ourselves that both Jews and Arabs, both Jews and Israelis and Palestinians, need the same Jesus to be saved.
Yes. Amen to that. So, I'm glad you said that. You have a recent article, and it's entitled, "Are They Building the Next Jewish Ghetto?" And we see these headlines, and it is hard to comprehend what these protesters think they're actually accomplishing for the Palestinians. People are scratching their heads saying, why are they there? Do they even know? But this is not what concerns you necessarily, and you communicate this so well in this article. You know, the fact they have the same tent, you know. But what should we be worried about above all? Are people actually asking about the Jews? What, from a Jewish perspective, how frightening is this?
Well, it is very frightening, and I'm looking at those riots, and of course, it's not over. It might not be over for a while.
Right.
They're not all just students from those schools. We know now that there's you know, like people that are just, you know, stirring the pot that have nothing to do with, you know, as being students from those different universities. They might have and probably have come from the open borders that we have right now. But what worries me is that when I look at what's happening and how the administration of different schools and the faculty and they're telling the Jewish people, don't come to class, stay home, because it'll be safer, do it online. And some of the rabbis and some of the Jewish leaders have also said that. A few of them have said that, but most of those schools are telling the Jewish kids and Jewish faculty, stay home. And then some of the home address and personal information of the Jewish faculty and probably some of the Jewish students as well has been published for people to know where they live. And I'm thinking, you know, I'm thinking about what happened after October 7th in France, where I'm from. I got some documents of people painting blue stencil Stars of David on the front of buildings in Paris and in some of Paris suburb to identify where the Jews live. Well, if you look at it and you know your history, this looks like a Kristallnacht 2.0. It looks like a repeat of Kristallnacht. Kristallnacht was the night of November 9th through the 10th of 1938, where in Berlin, Jewish businesses were ransacked and destroyed, Jewish synagogues, painting big white Stars of David on the windows and the word Jew on the windows to boycott the Jewish businesses. And that was the beginning. It was the official beginning of the Holocaust. And I'm looking at what's happening right now. Those painting of those windows, of those walls in France, and identifying where the Jews are and telling the Jews, go home for your own safety. And then, well, we find out that they know where you live, so we're going to have to move you to another location to keep you safe. This, to me, is a soft push for a new ghettoization, and yes. I'm not sure it's a word, a new ghettoization of the Jews, and that really scares me because after the ghettos came the trains, and after the trains came the death camps.
And in this article about the next Jewish ghetto, you mentioned that your Jewish father lived in Paris in the early 40s. He was only 16, but he told you about how his father, who had fought in World War I, was asked to turn into his bicycle. And then the radio, because even if you turn in your bicycle, you still have connection with the outside world. Then turn in the radio. Then there's curfews, so you can't move about, and now you're completely cut off. Then the controlled community, which is the ghetto, the last step before the camps. And you know, you hear about the Holocaust and the average Jewish American citizen of that era, and I've wondered for many years how they became so compliant, but I'm not wondering that anymore, Olivier.
Yeah, I mean, you know, when my father told me those stories, his father, Jewish father, you know, we have Jewish, you know, grandparents, great grandparents, as far as we can look, he had fought, his father had fought in the Great War of 1914-1918, and he considered himself Jewish at home, but a French citizen. So when he was asked to do all those things, he just said, I'm going to comply because it's the right thing to do. He never thought it was a Jewish thing. And so, you know, I just hope that we don't see, that we don't start seeing things like this. But unfortunately, I'm starting to see going in that direction. And it is very important right now for Christians to understand that we are at a place where praying for Israel, praying for the Jewish people is very important.
Yeah.
But we're at a place where the Christians who support Israel, the Christians who read their Bible and understand it properly, need to make it very clear, very vocal to their Jewish friends and the Jewish community that they are their friends, because Israel needs friends today more than ever.
Yes, they definitely do. And your article on the global Kristallnacht also is very, very good on shalomandmessiah.com. All these things we're talking about, you can find those articles on there. You also talk about in that article, hackers stole Jewish names from the 23andMe site, and they offered to sell those names. Also doxing in Australia, releasing personal info about Jewish people. Wow. This is Mary Danielson. You're listening to Stand Up for the Truth with Olivier Melnick at, again, Shalom in Messiah, shalomandmessiah.com. And when we come back, we are going to continue to talk about this raging anti-Semitism and how we should think about that. Stay with me.
Our social media pages are shadow banned. Thanks for your prayers and sharing our posts at standupforthetruth.com.
Welcome back to Stand Up for the Truth for May the 2nd. It's Thursday. My guest today is Olivia Melnick, shalominmessiah.com. You will find many great articles there. And I want to catch up with him on something that he's been working on, a new book, You Know Somebody Jewish, Now What? Answering 50 Important Questions. And also I want to ask you about this network of Christians that can help Jewish families in a time of crisis. So tell us the latest of what you're doing with these things.
Okay, so the new book is it's a book that I've been wanting to do for a while. It's based on all the questions that people ask me when I go to conferences and we do a Q&A session, and it's questions about to better understand the Jewish people. And it's a small book. It's very simple. It's not meant to be a big theological discourse. It's just like a manual to help people understand the Jewish people. And it's probably going to be out, I would say by the end of this month.
Okay.
And, the way it's connected to that network is that I want to make sure we make it available for all the people joining our network, mm-hmm. so they can have this as a manual to understand the Jewish people and be better prepared to share the hope,
okay.
That is within us, you know, with the Jewish people. Now, the network is something very, very important that I think that's where we are as a Christian community right now, is as it pertains to our relationship with the Jewish people in Israel. We are at a place where Christians are going to have to make a decision. I've heard it said by a few people in the last few weeks. What kind of Germans would you have been in the 1930s and 40s if you were a German?
Mm.
And so the question is the same. What kind of Christians are you? What kind of Christian are you today when it comes to taking a position on Israel and the Jewish people? Mary, I believe beyond the shadow of a doubt that the final dividing factor within the evangelical church is going to be support or lack of support for Israel. That's going to split the camp in half. And it's almost as an illustration of what will take place during the tribulation, as the parable of the sheep and the goats of Matthew 25. And I know this is the way it's going. And about 4 years ago, a group of us got together, and we had really the Lord had impressed on our hearts individually the same idea, the same vision, we could say, that it's going to get really bad for Jewish people, which is something that I've been saying for more than two decades now. And we thought, there's got to be something we can do to help the Jewish people when it gets bad.
Mm-hmm.
And then I thought about my family. My mother, lost her father in 1942 when he was taken by the Gestapo in the home, from the home where she lived, which is the home where I grew up in the suburb of Paris. And she was sent to the southwest of France to hide on a farm as a Catholic girl until the end of the war. And then the family who did that, out of the kindness of their heart, a family of farmers, became, in 2013, members of this very select group of people started by Yad Vashem Memorial Museum in Jerusalem, known as Righteous Among the Nations.
Mm-hmm.
So that family, that couple, they've been dead for years now. They posthumously became Righteous Among the Nations.
Uh-huh.
And I thought, here's a great way to redeem the past.
Yeah.
We can look at Christians today, and who can become, and I call them, new Righteous Among the Nations.
Mm.
Where are the Christians today who can actually reach out to Jewish people and rescue and shelter them at the risk of their own lives, without taking any money, without trying to do anything crazy, just to say, come in, I'll help you. So we started this network about 4 years ago, and it's there like-minded Christians who say, when it gets bad for the Jews, my house is open.
Wow.
And so we don't advertise. We don't have brochures. We don't really exist. Somebody saw my prayer letter yesterday, and they said, hey, I've been looking to find your network on the web. There's nothing. And I said, great, wonderful, good news. because we have to vet people.
Right.
So, but if you go to shalomandmessiah.com and you go to the Connect page, and you, it's easy to find, there will be for you a box to check saying, I want more to know more about Olivia's network, that Olivia's the network that Olivia spoke about. And that will start a vetting process, and eventually a person is accepted into the network, and we ask questions like, are you a doctor, a nurse, a lawyer, do you own a plane, a boat, a bus, a car, do you live on a farm? So we have things that we set up on this map of the U.S. where when we need to help out the Jewish community, we know where to send them. I my prayer is that we never have to use it, but that would be very naive of me to think we never have to use it.
Wow, but I love the idea. I love the idea, and it's going to cost believers something, but those who want to do it will do it, and they don't worry about the cost of that. So I'm really glad you told us about that. Olivia, I want to ask you about BDS, Boycott, Divest, and Sanctions, which is, of course, just another way to marginalize the Jews. And a lot of these protesters on campuses are calling on these universities to divest themselves from any investments regarding Israel. And this kind of makes me laugh, Olivia, because the Jews have contributed so many incredible things to our culture and our world. And if they're going to take this seriously, because you're talking about the first Intel processor that they developed and many more since, the smartphone camera lens technology, chemistry, physics, math, the first mobile phone, Motorola, are they willing to give up their mobile phones to truly divest from Israel? I think not, Olivier.
No. Of course, that's exactly the point. You stole my thunder.
Oh.
I wasn't make that point.
I'm sorry.
We're on the same page. That's good. I was going to make that point. BDS is so the modern BDS movement, the boycott, divestment, and sanction movement, really is not even 20 years old. It got started in 2005 by two men, Mahmoud Abbas, the leader of Fatah, the leader of the Palestinian Authority, a man with very much integrity, because I think he's in the 20th year of his four-year term as a leader of Fatah. So you know he has a lot of integrity.
Yeah.
He also, Mahmoud Abbas also, do you know what he wrote his doctoral dissertation on? He wrote it on Holocaust denial.
Of course.
So his Holocaust is the doctoral dissertation is on Holocaust denial, and the other man is Omar Barghouti, who is by his own saying a Palestinian, and his doctorate is from Tel Aviv University. I'm thinking, like, wait a minute, if we have to boycott everything, should you give your degree back? Because it's from Tel Aviv University.
Right.
So those men started this movement, and it's a very I have no problem with boycott. I think boycott, and I have my own things that I boycott in my life, and the older I get, the more I boycott, unfortunately, you know, on movies and music and different things. When you boycott something, just do it, but be consistent. And you don't boycott on Monday and on Tuesday. Well, I make an exception on Tuesday. It's kind of like being partially pregnant or keeping partial kosher. You can't do that.
Yeah.
You have to. You boycott or you don't. And those BDS proponents, they say we have to divest from those things. But like you said, they're not willing to not use a cell phone. They're not willing to not use a computer. And so they're being very, very hypocritical. And when I tell people the best way to fight BDS is to go on bdsmovement.net or .org. I think it's .net. And you go to bdsmovement.net, and then there's a list there, a tab with, you know, things to boycott. And they give you all the brands that are Israelis and go, like, don't buy, and they give you the whole list. And I'm going, like, great, thanks for doing the homework.
Yeah.
So now I know exactly what to buy to support Israel.
Wow. Yeah, the hypocrisy is just stunning, isn't it?
By the way, if I can recommend a book, and I'm not getting, you know, there's nothing in it for me, but Alan Dershowitz wrote a book called The Case Against BDS, Why Singling Out Israel for Boycott is Anti-Semitic and Anti-Peace. Very good book explaining and fighting BDS,
okay.
I might say so.
Great. Alan Dershowitz, yeah, he was on Fox just, I think it was yesterday or the day before, being interviewed, and he makes so much sense, and I was just totally engrossed in this interview with him. Highly recommend him. He's a thinker, no question about that. Olivia, I want to talk a little bit about the U.S. campuses and the article that the Gatestone Institute put out about grooming terrorists. Now, that just rings a bell with me because we have an open border. We have terrorists coming in from all over, and we think, well, we're just going to have direct frontal attacks. And we may. That's not out of the question. But grooming terrorists, and I just want to read a paragraph on this article and then ask you what you think. He says it's ironic that the current wave of protests on U.S. college campuses comes at a time when most Palestinian and Arab universities remain quiet. One would have expected to see such protests at university campuses in the West Bank and in Arab countries. There were some relatively small protests initially in Jordan and Egypt, but they didn't come close to the wave of this anti-Semitism. Those who are chanting, "We are all Hamas," are not helping the Palestinians even slightly. They are being used as human shields by the terrorist group Hamas in its genocidal war against the Jews. Olivia, they don't even know what they're talking about. They wouldn't survive a day under Hamas. Hamas hates them. But they're taking this extremist, unreasonable approach to this situation that they know absolutely nothing about. The Gen Zs have no idea of the political or spiritual ramifications. They know nothing about Islam. But they keep giving their opinions and taking action. So do you believe that they are using these youngsters with heads full of mush to be terrorists in this country?
Well, I think there's a very good chance that this could happen. This generation screaming, burn Tel Aviv, Jews back to the ovens, whatever, or Palestine, from the river to the sea, Palestine shall be free. I mean, you've seen the interviews now, of different places in the world, not just of the U.S. campus, where people will go and say, "Could you tell me what you're protesting against, and what are you?" What does that mean? And the kids look at each other going like, free the Palestinians. Free them from what? From where is the river? Where is the sea? They don't know. Mm-hmm. So we have a generation. I mean, the Gen Zs, I think there was a Pew survey that was done recently. I think either 33 or 37%, if my memory serves me right. 33 or 37%, about a third of Gen Zs are incapable of telling you what Auschwitz is or naming any camps. They don't know. They cannot even articulate a proper definition of the Holocaust. A third of Gen Zs. And so these are the kids that are being indoctrinated in universities right now, but we know it's been happening for a while now. They've been indoctrinated by Marxist professors, everywhere they go. The other day I saw a cartoon of a kid in a classroom. The professor's going, "Free Palestine," and the kid goes, "But it's chemistry." And it's the way it is right now. It doesn't matter where you go to school, you're going to be sold that propaganda of the poor Palestinian victims. And this new generation, they love social justice. Mm-hmm. So they're not going to check on anything. They're going to go like, "The poor Palestinian, that's enough for me, whatever it means."
Yeah.
And the problem is that in the mix of all these young adults, we have people that we don't know we know where they're coming from, probably the southern border, but we don't know where they're coming from as far as their background and their political ideology. We don't know, and they're pushing, and they're going to be very possibly using the students of the university the campuses. They're going to use them as to push the Hamas anti-Semitic agenda.
Sure.
And this could be, I have no idea. I'm going on the limb here. This could become the terrorist attack that people have talked about for a while now that it could be, it might not be another building with a plane. It might just be some of those people attacking in different areas of the U.S. simultaneously like this.
Yeah.
And frankly, Mary, the lack of response from our administration is really concerning.
Mm-hmm. It is indeed. And they act like a big brother. They're scolding Israel. They talk out of both sides of their mouths. They vote to send aid, but they're marginalizing a sovereign nation, a self-determining nation. And now the Biden White House wants to bring 800,000 Palestinians to America as refugees under the Refugee Act of 1980. This is disastrous, Olivier. I just can't imagine anything good coming out of any of this. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Listen, I came to America in 1985. I came to America in 1985 with a green card, proper papers, learned the language. I've been here for, 40 years now, almost 40 years. And I see all these people coming in, opening the way that people are coming in through the border it's not immigration, it's invasion.
Mm.
And to bring 800,000 Palestinians, we don't know. I'm always very careful when I say, well, not, and it's true, not all Germans were Nazis.
Right.
Not all Arabs or terrorists, not all Muslims are terrorists. I stick to that. This is important to say that, but I keep remembering that when you look at the numbers, 70% of Palestinians, 70, voted for Hamas in 2006.
Mm.
So it's a lot more than we think it is.
Right.
And so if you bring 800,000, Palestinians into the U.S., well, then if you do the math, it's probably about 560,000 who support Hamas. And those who support Hamas are not going to be our friends. We already know that. Mm-hmm. And we already have some of them in the U.S., and we see the damage that they're doing. And it was passed in the House, the passage of the Anti-Semitism mm-hmm. Awareness Act,
mm-hmm.
In the midst of a campus anti-Semitism that we're talking about. And Mary, you know, we have a definition of anti-Semitism. We have this Anti-Semitism Awareness Act. We have this the ambassador or the czar against anti-Semitism. Her name, is Deborah Lipstadt, and she's written several really good books on the topic. They get together, they put committees together, they talk, and then they have definitions. At the end of the day, nothing gets done.
Yeah.
Because it's like, if this is what it means to be anti-Semitic, and if you deviate, if you fall within that definition, then you break the law. Then what?
Right.
Nothing gets
mm-hmm.
done.
Mm-hmm.
So I can break the law all I want if nothing's going to get done. If all the students that have been fighting on us, screaming on campuses for the last week or so, were arrested and expelled, and then you go, okay, you know what, this is going to stop very quickly because they don't want a chance, being expelled and losing everything,
mm-hmm.
but nothing gets done,
mm-hmm.
and so you can write a definition, you can speak about it, you can put a committee together. They never enforce the law. And I've been following this for 23 years.
Mm-hmm.
Very seldom. It has to come to a case of death of several people for the authorities to go, okay, we got to get involved. We got to look into this. So that's
yeah.
I'm not too encouraged by this.
Yeah,
I know
okay.
I sound very negative, but
it's okay.
Nothing has been enforced.
Yeah, and we shouldn't
it's
be surprised.
Paper.
Yeah, right. We shouldn't be surprised by that. I mean, there are hate crimes legislations that I'm pretty sure they're threatening to use against Christians or whoever they want to, but they don't even enforce that unless they feel like it. So this, I'm glad you chimed in on that because this was on my list. Your House passes bill aimed to combat anti-Semitism amid college unrest. So don't hold your breath, in other words. And the State Department has been contracting with the UN since 1981 to ship foreign refugees into the U.S. And so now we have all these Palestinians. And I want to ask you also before we do run out of time, when school is out, which is going to be soon, when school is out, do you fear that a lot of this unrest, because it is still going on, even though UCLA, they've kicked them out, and it's going to take days to clean that mess up. But is this going to spill into the streets? Are we looking for a summertime of this going on and on and on?
You know what? Your guess is as good as mine.
Okay.
I think, personally, I think that on October 7th, it's kind of a silly analogy, but if anti-Semitism was toothpaste on October 7th, it was pushed out of the tube, and you cannot put toothpaste back into the tube. It's impossible.
Yeah.
So anti-Semitism is out. It's not going back. It's going to get worse. And we have to, you know, as Christians, we have to do whatever we can to fight it. But right now, I think Christians really need to ask themselves, I don't know how much I can do to fight it, but I know what I can do to come to the rescue of Jewish people who are going to be the targets of this anti-Semitism going crazy. And that, I think Christians need to start focusing on preparing to help the Jewish people. And that's why, again, coming back to that network, that's so important. We fight anti-Semitism. We show up at rallies for Israel. We send letters to senators and governors and politicians, and we send emails. All that is good. Our voices need to be heard. But Christians, the other day I had an idea that I've been sharing with a couple of pastor friends of mine, and I think we're gonna work on that with it, try to see if we can do something. We want to, there are a lot of churches in America, not a lot, but there are churches that you would call remnant churches.
Sure.
A good friend of mine, Pastor Brandon Holthouse, I don't know if you know who he is.
Mm-hmm.
He has a list of those churches on his website that he recommends people going to those churches in different states. And I told him the other day, I said, listen, it wouldn't take much for churches who have security, and many churches have their own people who have security, to call the rabbi of a community and say, hey, we have services on Sunday and we have our own security. We would like to offer you to send our security team to your synagogue on Saturday morning. We'll just be outside watching guard, just watching for anything that could happen. We'd like to offer that as a free service that would help rebuild the burnt bridges between the Jews and the Christians. We need to start thinking in those terms to rebuild the bridge, because we need to rebuild the trust between the Jews and the Christians so that we can again have a voice with the Jewish community to share the only message of hope and salvation that is the message of the gospel of Yeshua the Messiah.
Wow. What great practical advice of ways that we can help, because those who love Israel, we do want to help. I've been there several times, and it just changed my life. Do you have, we don't have much time left here, Olivier, unfortunately. Do you have an Israel, are you going to Israel anytime soon? I suppose you've had to cancel a trip or two.
Well, yeah, you know, I'm starting to develop a little bit of a complex, because I was supposed to take a tour of people on October 8th, October 7th happened. And so we had to cancel that. And then I was supposed to go on a mission trip to help soldiers of the IDF and meet with some of the leaders over there. The day we were leaving on the Sunday, and the Saturday night, Iran attacked Israel. So that was canceled. So somebody told me in my Bible study, said, Olivia, don't pick a date for Israel anymore, because every time you pick a date, a war starts.
Yeah.
So I'm getting a little nervous, but we're supposed to go middle of June. With a few pastors and myself to, it's a mission to, a trip. It's not a tourism.
Okay.
I have a tour supposed to go at the end of the year with my church. We're not sure it's going to go or not, but, at the worst case scenario is we would postpone it to 2025.
Wow.
It's a difficult time right now. They need the Christian love. They need the Christian, support. But it's very shaky what's happening there, and so we have to be careful. So hopefully I'll go in June. I'll be able to come back with a report. But I'm looking forward to go there and help whichever way I can.
Yeah, I have a pastor friend who was supposed to come back on the day that Iran went after Israel, and they didn't go anyway because there was no lodging. Because there's so many displaced Israelis, they're staying in all the hotels in the northern area, and they can't find the hotels to accommodate. So even if tourism were to come back up, that country's never going to be the same. After this, I think we're just in a situation that is unresolvable except by Bible prophecy and the hand of the Lord himself. So, what incredible times to be in. Just everybody keep your eyes on the skies and on the headlines. Olivier Melnyk, what a treat to have you with me today. Any last thoughts? We have about a minute left.
Last thought is for people to keep in prayer for Israel and the Jewish people. And again, I know I sound like a broken record, but examine your heart and see where you are in your relationship with the Lord and how you can become partners and help reach out to the Jewish community. I would invite people to join visit shalominmessiah.com, connect with us, and be a part of our ministry and help us reach out to the Jewish community. I don't think it's going to get better, but we have a chance as believers to redeem the past. There were too many bystanders in the past.
Yeah, definitely. What a treat to have you on, Olivier. I hope we can do this again sometime. Lord bless you. We're going to be praying for you and looking for updates on YouTube or wherever. And God bless you. Thank you so much.
God bless. Thank you.
All right, Friday, Dr. Ingrid Skop, that's tomorrow, Vice President and Director of Medical Affairs at the Charlotte Lozier Institute. And we're going to talk about abortion and the abortion kill pill. So I hope you can be with me tomorrow. Therefore, my beloved brethren, be steadfast and immovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord, knowing that your labor is not in vain in the Lord. Have a great day.